I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Lori Wallmark, author of the new children's book on the Lower East Side, Rivka's Presence. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We're now just a couple of days before the summer solstice, longest day of the year here in the Northern Hemisphere. We Jews have always used a calendar based on the cycles of the moon rather than the sun, a lunar, not a solar calendar. Even so, the sun has played a major role in our religious development. And certainly, for all other cultures in the world, the sun has had a central place in their theologies and sanctuaries. During a sabbatical trip I took around the world, 7 or 8 years ago, I visited nearly 150 of the holiest places on earth in some 20 countries and explored what originally made them sacred in the first place. And while there were a variety of common themes among these holy places, the orientation of the sacred sites to the rising, or sometimes the setting sun, was almost always one of the reasons they were chosen. That was true on every continent I visited, from Europe to Asia to Africa to Australia to South America, you know, all the inhabited ones, and it was true for every single religious tradition. Everyone keeps at least one eye on the sun when they locate their holiest places of worship, and everyone relates the rays of the rising sun to the presence of the divine here on earth. This goes back to the deepest parts of our evolution, to the way in which we sought light and warmth in dark, cold times. But the focus on the sun in religious tradition is just as true of societies that developed in scorching climates like Egypt or Cambodia or Belize as it is in frigid places like Poland or Finland or the Andes, where the rays of the sun provide life-giving warmth and energy. Of course, no matter what the ambient temperature is, it's always true that without the energy of the sun, our earth would be barren of life. Virtually everything needed to grow plants and evolve and sustain life comes from our local star, you know, Sol. So it's understandable why so many religions look to the sun as a kind of deity, or at least a representation of divine power and favor. Ancient Egypt, the culture in which our Israelite ancestors frequently lived, saw the sun as its most important god, Ra, and had other divine manifestations of the solar disk as gods too, such as Aton. Their temples were all oriented towards the rising sun. And the sacred sites of the Canaanites, the Phoenicians, the Philistines, and the Babylonians also faced the rising sun. Japan defined itself as the land of the rising sun, and the holy emperor was believed to descend directly from it. So look, we Jews didn't turn to the sun like so many others did. We turned instead towards Jerusalem, wherever we were. For exiles living in the West, that meant our synagogues were turned east, of course, the direction of the rising sun. But for those Jews living east of Israel, that meant that they oriented their temples westward, away from the sun. But that's not the whole story. The choice of Jerusalem as capital of ancient Israel may have been topographical and also related to the sun. In the days when the temple stood, prior to the Roman destruction in the year 70, the dawning light of the sun would hit the Mount of Olives first and then spread out over the city of Jerusalem. The temple itself faced east, towards the, yep, you got it, rising sun. And as soon as light indicated the dawning of the new day, Olot HaShachar, the priests and people would say the morning Shema out loud. Then the Kohanim, the priests, would make the morning sacrifice, and the day was properly begun. The round shape of Jerusalem, a city surrounded by a circle of mountains, is the shape of a cup, a kind of sacred shape. King David chose Jerusalem as his capital city, and a sacred city it was too. Well, he certainly knew Jerusalem. He was a shepherd from Bethlehem, just a few miles away. The temple that Solomon built faced east towards the rising sun, just like Karnak in Luxor, Egypt, like so many other ancient temples. The only other place along the range of the mountain and hill spine of Israel that has the shape of Jerusalem, a cup-like circle of mountains or hills surrounding a town or city, is Hebron, which was the original capital city of Israel, where David put it the first time, the place where the tabernacle was located for years. So, even though we are much more focused on the cycles of the moon in Jewish tradition, the sun played a key role in Judaism too. There's even an obscure Jewish ritual, the Birkat HaChama, blessing for the sun. It is performed once every 28 years. Supposedly at the time, the sun lines up and returns to the point it was, at the very first moment of the beginning of creation. During these days closest to the summer solstice, it's worth taking a few moments, reflecting on all of God's creation, of the great source of our light and energy, without which we wouldn't be here at all. There's a blessing for any wonderful natural phenomenon. It goes like this. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Oseh Ma'aseh V'Reishit. Blessed are you, God, ruler of the universe, who made the great work of creation. To play us in this morning on Two Jewish, here's Israeli singer Omer Adam singing Modeh Ani, a morning prayer, and a poem that says, I thank you, God, every morning.
מודה אני כל בוקר שהחזרת את נשמתי מודה אני על בגד שנחת על גופי שלא יהיה לי קר אתה שומר עליי מודה אני כל בוקר על האור על עצם היותי מודה אני עליכם שנחת לשולחני שלא אהיה רעב שלא אדע כאב על אין ספור חיוכי מודה אני על כל כישרונותיי ועל כל שיריי את כולם אקדיש לך דע לך, דע לך, שמודה אני לך. אצעק לך, אדיר שמך, אליך אקרא יה, לך חיי, לך ליבי, לתודתי. מודה אני כל בוקר על כוחי על אבי ועל אמי מודה אני על גשם שנתת בשדותיי לדאוג לאוהביי נתת לי חיי על יום המנוחה מודה אני על שפע וברכה על המשפחה כל כולי רק בזכותך דע לך דע לך שמודה אני לך אצעק לך אדיר שמך אליך אקראיה
That was Omer Adam singing Modeh Ani. Our guest on Too Jewish this morning is the author of a charming children's book that focuses on life in the Lower East Side of New York during the greatest period of Jewish immigration to the U.S., the early 20th century. The book is called Rivka's Presence. Meet Lori Wallmark, its author, when she joins us in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Lori Wallmark, has written a really quite wonderful children's book about the Lower East Side, and I think it's unique in terms of recent Jewish children's books. She's the author of Ada Brian Lovelace and The Thinking Machine, which got a number of excellent reviews and a whole series of other books. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why a book about a kid growing up on the Lower East Side in the midst of the Jewish tenement era?
Okay, well, there's a museum in New York called the Tenement Museum.
By the way, wonderful museum. Took my kids there years ago. It's really extraordinary.
Absolutely. And I went there for the first time, and one of the things you do is you visit a tenement apartment, and the guide tells you all about what life was like for the people living in the apartment. And I thought, this is amazing. This is going to make a book. I have to turn this into a book somehow. But I had no idea what. I mean, it was just an idea. Maybe 5 years later, I went back to the museum and took the same tour and had the same thought. There's a book here. I just don't know what that book is. And I kept thinking about it. My parents grew up on the Lower East Side. And my mother was a little girl, just like Rivka, at about the same time period. So I thought about her growing up in that era, living like the people did then. And what was her story? And I knew one of her stories was she really, really could not wait to start school. She was so excited about starting school. And I thought, okay, maybe I put a little girl who wanted to start school. But that still doesn't make a story. You need some conflict in there. And that's when I thought about the idea of having the conflict be the 1918 flu. And you that's how it all started.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't have timed it much better. It obviously has relevance. I have to admit, I was a little worried when you talked, when it started to talk about a shirtwaist, that somehow it was going to jump back to the shirt triangle shirtwaist fire. But even though it's in the midst of the flu, it's not a tragic book, and it shows kind of a vitality of life. We tend to think about that as, you know, a fairly miserable period, new immigrants coming in, but there's a lot of charm to this book.
Well, there's a big community, and I think that's a big part of the book is the community. I had Mama go to work at the shirtwaist factory because my grandmother worked at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory.
Oh, my
goodness. Did survive. She was one of the few.
Wow.
So that also was in the back of my mind. A lot of family history went into this book.
Well, we will talk about that and much more when we return with Lori Wallmark. Her book is called Rivka's Presence. I keep wanting to say Rivka Presents, which is not right. Rivka's Presence, it's charming. It's really a terrific book and a great piece of education for any kid and some adults. We'll talk more about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area with weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or attend on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school registrations open now for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us for our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. Shabbat morning services begin with Torah study at 9 a.m. or just come for services at 10 a.m. All with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. Our musical services are in person and available virtually, and all of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Jewish Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Today, let's talk about a country with a long Jewish history, important relationship with Israel, complicated, and a big election in which the longtime leader of Turkey, Erdogan, was forced into a runoff election that he won fairly handily, or at least that's what we think. Who knows? Maybe you can lay the groundwork for us a little bit and what it all means.
Well, a few things. First of all, interesting to me that you, in describing Turkey, neglected to mention that it's a key NATO member.
Yeah, well, it's also a big Muslim country. I don't know, a few things I didn't say
and
about Turkey.
It's
yes.
One of the few NATO countries that used to share a land border with the former Soviet Union. Now the only one that shares a land border with Russia is Norway. But Turkey shared a land border with Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, and those were all constituent republics of the former Soviet Union. So Turkey was a flank state, so-called.
Yeah, it was a big part of the whole Cuban Missile Crisis, because the U.S. had missiles in Turkey.
And for us foreign policy nerds, that's the most distinctive thing about Turkey. Also, Turkey, ever since Atatürk took over from the Ottomans... in
the
early
1920s, in charge at that moment,
Turkey has been, at least technically, a secular democracy, and periodically the army stepped in to save the country from would-be dictators. Now Erdogan effectively neutered the army and has consolidated unprecedented amounts of power.
I mean, in that attempted coup a couple of years ago, he won. Usually it's the military that wins. It was shocking, actually, to see that.
The apparent coup, which might have been engineered. But in any case, yes, Turkey has an election system very much like France, whereby if no candidate wins a clear majority in the first round, the top two candidates go to a runoff a few weeks later. And that runoff took place quite recently. And Erdogan won by approximately 52-48. So it wasn't like a slam dunk, even in the second round, but he did better than many people expected. Thanks largely to conservative religious women who seemed to vote for him in an overwhelming majority.
Reflexively, yeah.
Now, implications of this victory. First of all, because his position is now stronger and he doesn't have to prove what a great nationalist he is, Erdogan is likely to relent on his opposition to Swedish membership in NATO. Shows you where my priorities are,
yeah.
NATO, NATO, NATO. And Turkey will probably continue to have increasingly warm relations with Israel. It's a profitable relationship for both countries in many ways, and a shocking percentage of workers in Israel, particularly in construction work, come from Turkey. They're like Gastarbeiter who live in dormitories, and they don't speak Hebrew, obviously. Many of them don't speak English. They're not highly educated, but they're effective and efficient workers, and that's one of Turkey's major exports is skilled construction workers.
Right.
Now, you may ask, how skilled are they since they built those areas that collapsed so quickly
in the earthquake? Yeah.
But, you know, very few countries have mastered the technology for building earthquake-resistant buildings. That's like apparently a highly specialized thing, which is not yet shared by Turkey. We may see a continued concentration of power in the hands of the presidency of Turkey, but we might also see a relaxation in some key areas. And one of the areas of special concern to the U.S. and to NATO as a whole is Turkey's position on the war in Ukraine. Russia is a major trading partner for Turkey. So was Ukraine. Now Ukraine's not doing much trading with anybody. And Turkey has not been entirely loyal to NATO's line on this war, to the NATO common position. And certainly it's far off from like the EU standard, the gold standard. But then again, that's true for Israel as well.
Sure. I mean, Turkey's actually been actively kind of playing both sides of the fence, and Israel's pretty much tried to do a little bit of the same. I think that's true. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with it, Turkey's relationship with Israel, which has kind of seesawed over the last 10 years, 15 years, from very close to very distant. Kind of a rapprochement's been happening the last couple of years.
It's been on a warming trend, and I think that will accelerate now.
Thanks so much, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, Rivka goes to the dentist and asks him how much it'll cost to extract a wisdom tooth. $1,000, the dentist says. That's ridiculous, Rivka says. Is there a cheaper way? Well, the dentist says, if I don't use any anesthetic, I could knock it down to $500. Still too expensive, Rivka says. Okay, says the dentist. What if I save on anesthesia and just rip the tooth out with a pair of pliers? I might get away with charging you just $100. No, moans Rivka, still too much. Says the dentist, scratching his head. Well, if I let one of my students do it without anesthetic and use a pair of old pliers, you know, rusty probably, but just for the experience, you understand, I suppose I could charge you $25. Marvelous, says Rivka. Book my husband Moshe for next Tuesday. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jews. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's Parsha, the people of Israel have come to the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery. But a team of spies comes back with a bad report. We aren't strong enough to conquer the land. Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. That rebellion fails, and a verdict from God is proclaimed. A lack of faith lies at the heart of the problem, and God decides that this generation can never come into the Holy Land. They will have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years. Until they are all gone, then a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth, untainted by slavery and its mentality, can arise. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Kohen named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. He accuses them of hubris, chutzpah, of overweening pride and egotism. Born into the same tribe, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own. Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us? He asks. His rebellion threatens the very foundation of the Israelites' leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this Israelite enterprise, if it's all a matter of ego and self-aggrandizement, they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery. And some propose now to do just that. But Korach dissembles. That is, he's a liar. For Moses clearly has had no great desire for his high office. He has held it as a sacred trust, forced on him almost by God. Korach is threatening not Moses' authority, but God's. Our Torah portion tells us that in order to determine the ongoing leadership of Israel, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match, and the net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed, and Moses and Aaron's leadership is fully vindicated. It's nice when God has your back on these little conflicts. One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we need to look in the mirror. But the even more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, which is focused instead on personal aggrandizement, will fail. Only through faith and devotion will we be able to reach our own promised land. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Lori Wallmark, tells us how the COVID pandemic reflected themes she highlights in her wonderful new children's book, Rivka's Presence, only it's set during the flu epidemic of the early 20th century. Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The annual claims conference negotiations with the German government on reparations reached agreement last week, and there were surprises. Stuart Eisenstadt has served as the special negotiator for the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany since 2009. This year, he looked at Germany's economic and political landscape, high inflation, spiraling fuel costs, unprecedented government spending on defense to support Ukraine in the war with Russia, adding in a German finance minister, Christian Lindner, who was elected less than 2 years ago on a platform of budget cuts, fiscal restraint, and smaller government, and things did not look promising. And yet, the compensation package Eisenstadt helped secure for the claims conference, more than $1.4 billion, was the largest figure agreed to in a single year since German reparations began more than 70 years ago. This reflected a recognition that even as the number of Holocaust survivors dwindles, estimates today are 240,000 remain alive, the needs of the remaining survivors are increasing as they age. Some of the $1.4 billion that Germany agreed to spend will be paid directly to survivors. The bulk will fund social welfare services like home care, food packages, and such, administered through 300 agencies across 83 countries that house survivors. Germany also agreed to boost funding for Holocaust education programs. This is perhaps the most productive session we've had, Eisenstadt said, and the fact that it occurred almost 80 years after the war is testimony to the Claims Conference's relentless pursuit of justice and the partnership we've had with the German government. Total direct compensation to Holocaust survivors from Germany is expected to reach $535 million next year, that's in 2024, paid out in direct pensions to survivors. Negotiations resulted in 4 more years of hardship payments, direct allocations to survivors who didn't qualify for pensions, introduced following the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. More than 128,000 survivors will receive about $1,360 in 2024, an amount that will go up slightly each year through 2027. The hardship payments were negotiated on top of the regular Holocaust survivor pensions. They primarily benefit Jews from the former Soviet Union who were, generally speaking, not interned in camps or ghettos and thus weren't included in the original pension program. These Jews survived the Nazi Einsatzgruppen killing units that murdered more than 1 million Jews, but weren't directly in camps. Social services is another category of aid that skyrocketed over the past 2 decades. German spending for social services will reach about $890 million in 2024, an increase of $105 million over last year. 15 years ago, that total was less than $50 million. In 2023, 120,000 survivors also received home care, medical transportation, and other forms of support through Jewish social service agencies. Survivors are getting more frail. They need more care and assistance, said Ruben Rotman, president of the Network of Jewish Human Service Agencies. Germany also agreed to increasing funding for Holocaust education around the world, providing the Claims Conference with $150 million for educational programs over the next 4 years. That money is meant to counter findings from recent surveys showing the public is growing less knowledgeable about the Holocaust. According to a 2018 survey commissioned by the Claims Conference and covered on Too Jewish, half of American adults could not name a single concentration camp. A third were under the impression that the number of Jewish victims was far lower than the 6 million who were actually murdered by the Nazis. The Claims Conference's education budget helped pay for the production of Son of Saul, the extraordinary and devastating 2015 Hungarian movie set in the Auschwitz concentration camp. It won an Oscar for Best Foreign Film. In other news, in Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives voted unanimously to approve a resolution demanding Russia release Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovitz. The congressional resolution, which does not have the binding force of law, calls for Gershkovitz to be released from prison immediately and demands that he be given full access to U.S. consular staff until he's released. Gershkovitz, 31 years old, has been held in a Russian prison since March 29th on allegations of espionage. He, the U.S. government, and the Wall Street Journal say these are completely spurious. His pretrial detention was recently extended until at least August 30th. If convicted, Gershkovitz could face up to 20 years in a Russian penal colony. Gershkovitz is the son of Jewish refugees from the Soviet Union. He is the first American journalist arrested on espionage charges since the end of the Cold War. His case has attracted interest and support from Jews and Jewish organizations around the world who have demanded his release. The resolution last week was introduced by Republican Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. No evidence has been presented to back up this accusation because there is no evidence, McCaul said on the House floor. Speaking of Gershkovitz, he was simply doing his job reporting on the news in Russia. But we know that the war criminal Putin doesn't like that. He doesn't want his own people to know about the atrocities that he is committing in Ukraine. He doesn't want them to know about the corruption within his own government or how he has turned their country into an international pariah. In Israel, the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, censured an officer for actions contributing to the tragic and mistaken killing of a Palestinian toddler earlier this month, said the incident revealed gaps in the command and control of the commanders involved. On June 1st, an IDF soldier shot 2-year-old Mohammed Tamimi and injured his father, Haitham Tamimi, while responding to a shooting near the Israeli West Bank settlement of Halamish, also known as Neve Tzuf. The toddler died of his wounds a few days later. This year has seen an escalation of violence in the West Bank. More than a dozen Israeli civilians have been murdered in terror attacks. More than 100 Palestinians, both terrorists and civilians, have been killed in the midst of clashes with Israeli forces. Just last week, an Israeli civilian and 4 soldiers were wounded in another Palestinian shooting in the West Bank. A recently completed IDF investigation of the June 1st incident found that the Tamimis were shot when a soldier fired at them after receiving permission from his commander, mistakenly thinking they were the Halamish gunmen. At around the same time, another officer fired into the air, contrary to orders. The investigation said the soldier who shot the Tamimis heard the gunfire and thought it came from Palestinian attackers, prompting him to fire. The IDF is censuring the officer who fired in the air contrary to orders and is deciding whether to further investigate the incident. The investigation revealed gaps in the command and control of the commanders in the incident, as well as in the reports and dialogue between forces in the field, which led to wrong decision-making, the IDF investigation concluded. Major General Yehuda Fox, the IDF's Central Command Chief, said he regrets the harm to civilians and the death of the toddler. We will continue to learn and improve in order to precisely target terrorism. And in happier news, Israel won third place in the under-20 Soccer World Cup last week, capping a historic run in its first ever appearance at the tournament by beating South Korea 3-1. Local Jews and Israeli visitors made up a big portion of the crowd of 15,000 at the stadium in La Plata, Argentina, about 40 miles outside of Buenos Aires. Israel's success at the tournament, which showcases the next generation of global soccer stars, has been a galvanizing event for South American Jews. "We were so welcome," said Ofer Chaim, the Israeli team's coach. "The crowds sing Hatikva. It's very moving for me and the players." The Israeli victory last weekend came at the end of a surprising string of wins for the Israeli team, which beat Uzbekistan and Japan before shocking Brazil, one of the world's best soccer nations, in the quarterfinals. Israel lost 1-0 in the semifinals to Uruguay, which won the tournament, beating Italy in the final. 2 days ago, I was disappointed we couldn't reach the final, Elyam Konsipolsky, an Israeli midfielder, said. But now I'm very happy. Third place in the world is amazing. For a tiny country like Israel, it is indeed. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Lori Walmark is the author of the new kids book, Rivka's Presence, which is, I think, one of the most interesting and enjoyable Jewish kids books I've seen in a long time. She's the author of Ada Brian Lovelace and the Thinking Machine, which won awards, Grace Hopper, Queen of Computer Code, and Hedy Lamarr's Double Life, among other things. She has a degree, MFA, from Vermont College of Fine Arts, and was a software engineer and computer science professor who has turned over a new leaf, or several new pages might be the right term. So in writing Rivka's Presence, you really immerse us in the culture of tenement life. Now, I know that book publishers usually pair up authors with illustrators sort of sometimes against their will. This is beautifully illustrated with great level of detail. Did you get to work with the illustrator? How did it work out?
Not directly. The illustrator is actually Swedish, so we never met each other. But I did get to see the sketches along the way, so I could make comments, things that weren't quite right in the sketches, or just my own opinion. And then the illustrator and the art director either took them or didn't take them. You know, that it is their part of the process. But I was very happy to have my opinion asked.
So it takes place during the last great pandemic, the terrible flu epidemic of the early part of, just after World War I. Tell us about how that was, researching that, putting that into the book, and how you handled it for kids.
Well, these days, all kids know about pandemics. It was a part of their life, especially the kids of the age this book is written for. You know, the kindergarten, first, second, third grade, they are totally immersed in what pandemic life is like. So I think that helps in reading the book for them, that they realize it's a problem. It's not something abstract. It's a real life situation that they understand. As far as research, I read a lot of books about the pandemic. I read a lot of books about life on the Lower East Side, immigration. You do a lot of research, and it just isn't as obvious as you might think in the book, because you take a little bit here, a little bit there, and you put together a book from it.
you know, it kind of sounds Jewish. You take a little bit of this and that, you throw it in, and you got chicken soup, you know. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. How much? Until it's enough.
Exactly.
How long did it take you to write the book?
That's an interesting question, because I always thought this would be my first published book. And it's actually going to be my 8th published book. So I worked on it maybe 20 years ago, submitted it places, no one wanted to buy it. Okay, that happened. And I just put it away. I thought of it as a learning experience. I put it away. And then an editor put on social media, where are all the books for little Jewish girls that aren't Holocaust stories?
Yeah, boy, I agree.
And I was like, I have one. Right, so I revised it. We submitted it to her. I revised it for her, and then she turned it down. Okay, back under the bed it went. Didn't even really think about it. Then one day my agent calls and says, how would you like to have your book published by Random House Studio?
Well, okay.
Like, what? Huh? What's going on here? Even though the book was not on submission at all, it was still under my bed. My agent had it in the back of her mind, and she was talking to an editor and pitched it. So the lesson is never give up.
Never give up. All right. I got a book. I guess I shouldn't give up on it. Also,
oh, absolutely not. You just never know. Times change. What people are looking for changes. I'd like to believe that I became a better writer, so the book itself was better.
Sure. You mentioned your mom worked for the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory.
My grandmother.
Your grandmother. Can you tell us that story?
Not a whole lot. Just that luckily she did not expire during the fire.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's considered one of the worst, if not the worst, labor accidents in America, at least non-mine related ones.
She used to talk just about the drudgery. You know, you're in this small, hot, you know, stifling room, you know, it's crowded, it's noisy, and that's what you did. You worked 6 days a week, and that's how you survived.
10, 12 hours a day.
Exactly.
And obviously the safety conditions were abominable.
Oh. But of course she never thought about it, because they were all like that. It's not like
not like that production facility was different from all the other garment production facilities in New York at the time.
Right.
The flu plays a big role. I'm not giving anything away when I say it's not a tragedy, as it turns out, for her and her family. How did you make that decision?
I needed a way to prevent Rivka from being able to go to school. And even by then, school was mandatory. Kindergarten wasn't, but school was.
First grade was, yeah. And they had truancy officers and all of
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So what could be preventing her from going to school? She herself could be sick of some sort, not even necessarily the flu. That would prevent her. But then she couldn't do anything else that she does in the story. So I kept coming back to taking care of her little sister. But why would she have to take care of her little sister? And that's how the flu finally entered in, because until the flu happened, Mama did piecework in the apartment so she could be there taking care of Rivka's little sister. It's when she needed to make more money, because Papa had the flu, that's where the obstacle for starting school happens.
And
you know, back to my mother's story of wanting so much to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
Part of her story is she only spoke Yiddish. My mother didn't speak English because no one in her family spoke English.
Sure.
So when she did finally start school, boy, was that a surprise.
I bet she had to learn English fast.
And little kids do. You know, and then like many immigrants, children of immigrants, she then translated for her parents for the rest of her life.
Right. Did they ever learn English, your grandparents?
No.
Always just Yiddish.
Right. Well, I shouldn't say that. It is possible they learned English. I never heard them speak English.
Sure. Where was your family? Where were your grandparents from originally?
Poland, Russia, you know, depends upon when you ask.
Russia, Poland, like my grandparents used to say, as though that were an actual country, because you never knew in which week it was going to be part of one country or the other.
Right, so the grandparents on both sides came over in the late 1800s.
In the great Jewish wave of immigration, right?
Exactly, and everyone settled on the Lower East Side.
Have you ever gone back and found their actual address? Is it still a walk-up?
No, I never have, because by the time I was born in the Bronx,
uh-huh.
So they had moved out. So I've never thought about going back. That's a good idea. I'll have to ask my brother, actually, where they lived, because I don't know.
That would be an interesting thing to check out. Who knows? You know, it could be a Chinese laundry now. It could be anything, right? But restaurant, empty lot, a high rise, a gentrified set of lofts. It's hard to say, but I think it would be interesting to reconnect with, some of those roots. It's a terrific.
Right, and when I went on the tours, the apartment they show you is a one bedroom apartment. And when I was born, we lived in a one-bedroom apartment. Two parents, three children, one-bedroom apartment.
Right.
But it wasn't until I looked at those one-bedroom apartments that I realized, tiny one-bedroom apartment.
Really small.
Right.
With the bathroom and the hall shared by, I don't know, four, five, eight, a bunch of those apartments.
Exactly.
Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Rivka's presence?
Well, I'm lucky that my name, Lori Walmark, is short enough that I can use it on any social media and unique enough. So if you go to Lori Walmark, LauriWallmark.com, you can see about me, you can see about all my other books. So this is my only quote-unquote Jewish book. I have a book about Hedy Lamarr, who is Jewish.
Yeah.
I have a book coming out also in July about the chess grandmaster Judith Polgar, who is Jewish.
Well, I think those count too, then. We'll take them. Lori, thank you. The book is called Rivka's Presence. It's just out. It's a terrific book. Highly recommend it. I'm sure you can get it wherever books are sold. Check with your local independent bookseller if you can. Lori, thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Charles Jacobs, the controversial Jewish activist against anti-Semitism, co-editor of the new book, Betrayal, the Failure of American Jewish Leadership. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning is a little Klezmer Freilach, bouncy way to end the morning. Enjoy. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.